And the reason is that different dark matter experiments use different nuclei. And so if you just publish, say, a cross-section scattering off a xenon, then I don't know how to compare it to an experiment that uses germanium. So what you can do is sort of normalize it in such a way that you're defining an effective dark matter nucleon cross-section, which is sort of cheating because we've seen that you can, for instance, have different proton and neutron couplings, and so just defining an effective nucleon coupling isn't necessarily the correct thing to do, but it at least gives us a number which we can take and compare with respect to different experiments. And this is also pretty easy to calculate because we don't have to worry too much about these form factors, and so this gives us sort of up to a factor of a few the correct prediction for comparing a theory to an experiment. Then we talked about how the experiments actually work. And so now what I want to do is talk about the current bounds. Let me go do it over here where I have more room. So the current bounds are going to be on this, expressed in terms of this parameter sigma naught, so that we can compare different ones. But at the moment, for most of the WIMP parameter space, there's essentially one or two experiments that are dominating all of the constraints. As you may have guessed, we have not seen a definitive signature of dark matter in direct detection experiments. The only thing we can confidently talk about are constraints. So on the y-axis, we're going to put sigma naught, and this is typically expressed in units of centimeters squared. So it's a little annoying that they use different units than the indirect detection people who do centimeters cubed per second. The main difference is that in indirect detection, you're doing this thermal average over sigma v, so that's a little bit more natural. But you can just map between them by multiplying by the speed of light, okay, or dividing. On the y-axis, we have our dark matter mass. And so what they do is for each particular dark matter mass, they figure out, okay, how many recoils would it lead based on a given cross-section, and then they use their observed number of hits to put a limit on that. So for instance, in the Xenon 100 experiment, which is not quite the best, but pretty good, this is 100 kilogram of Xenon. The actual target volume that they use is about 35 kilograms. The rest they use is this active veto. They see two events in the signal region from about two-thirds of a year of running time. Lux, which is also a xenon-based experiment, this is a bit better. This one, they don't explicitly divide into signal and control regions. They just show all of their hits and they do a fit. Okay, but their constraints turn out to be a bit better, so the equivalent is once you cut on these different scintillation variables, they're really seeing essentially nothing. Okay. Okay, so this is what the curve looks like in terms of shape. So this is about 10,000. This here is about 10 to the minus 45. -44, -43. Okay. So to explain these different features, what happens here is that sigma naught is basically independent of m chi in this region. Okay. The reason being that all of these reduced masses that show up in various places just become the nucleus. But we know that our number density of dark matter goes like 1 over the mass of dark matter. So if I have a heavier dark matter particle, there are fewer of them. So they're scattering the same rate, but there are fewer. So the rate goes up in this linear way. Then here we have a sharp cutoff. And the reason for this is that the recoil energy is tied to the mass of the dark matter particle. And basically, there's just not enough recoil to pass the experimental cuts. So usually there's some threshold for both of these. It's about 5 keV. And we saw that for 100 GeV WIMP, we derived this yesterday, that the typical E recoil is about 10 to 100 keV. So you can imagine that if you then go down to few GeV masses, this just scales linearly, suddenly all of your scatterings are just too light. The reason why they have to impose this is just that, of course, there's thermal noise and there's all sorts of little hits from, say, low energy processes. And if these processes all sort of blow up as you go to lower energy. Yes.
So which is the extruded region?
Oh, I should say, yeah. So this is the extruded region. So because going up is higher rate. Okay. So this is the extruded region, and this is the viable region. Yes.
So you're saying in the right, the sigma zero is independent of n guide, but I thought you were plotting sigma zero. You said that the rate will grow as n guide. I'm a little bit confused.
Ah, sorry. Yeah. Yes. So I shouldn't say sigma zero. I should say, what should I say? Maybe I should say the matrix elements are the dependent of n chi. What I mean is that when you're scattering at these high energies, those reduced masses that showed up in the forms that we had before, they're m nucleon m chi over m nucleus plus m chi, and this just goes to m nucleus in the high mass limit. The matrix element is also independent of m chi. So what you end up with is just something that falls as the density of dark matter. But yeah, that was a bit sloppy, so a good call. So we can get some estimate of how small this number is by comparing it to some of the kinds of numbers we are throwing around for thermal freeze out. So remember that the sigma v that we needed for the relic abundance was of the order of 6 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. Now, I would caution about converting this rate directly into a direct detection scattering rate because, of course, this is an annihilation process. This is an elastic scattering process in a non-relativistic phase. But at least gives us some, you know, rough order of magnitude of where you might expect these things to come. Okay. So what we can do is we can divide by 3 times 10 to the 10 centimeters per second. We get about 2 times 10 to the minus 36 centimeters squared. So this means that in the stupidest dimensional analysis that I can do, the current limits are about 10 orders of magnitude stronger than what I might expect for a thermal relic. Okay. And so in particular, we can take some simple freeze-out model. And the first freeze-out model that we ever looked at was chi chi bar going through the Z, the standard model fermion. And what we found was that for m chi of about, say, 700 GeV or 500 GeV, that this was the correct abundance. Okay. So now I can go and basically, for these Bs, these were defined like this. I can just say, OK, BQ is some G of the Z to the quark, GZ chi. And I can just plug in whatever characteristic values are. So these are fixed by the standard model. These I can determine, but I need them to be order one. So just for the purpose of concreteness, I'm now going to just put in GZ chi is equal to G standard model neutrino, just because why not? Neutrinos are neutral, they're weakly interacting. It's in some sense, they're the perfect candidate, just a heavy neutrino. And you'll soon see why we don't talk about this anymore. Okay, so I should say this is the constraint from Lux, and xenon 100 is very competitive with this. So xenon has an atomic number of 54, a mass number of 131. And when I plug in everything, what I find is that sigma naught is basically -2.5×10⁻³⁹ cm². So this is a bit smaller. It's a few orders of magnitude smaller than just the naive scaling based on the relic abundance. But as soon as I look at this plot, I see that I'm still excluded by 6 or so orders of magnitude. Okay. So what that tells me is this is completely excluded. And this is a general story. If you have the interaction that's giving you thermal freeze out also give you a spin-independent scattering cross-section, you're just completely done. Okay? Unless you start doing weird things with how this vector couples or something like that. But direct detection experiments are extremely constraining. And they're some of the strongest limits that we have on dark matter interactions. So when these experiments were first being built, this wasn't some pie in the sky kind of let's hope we actually see dark matter. It was people really thought we're going to see dark matter. And when they literally just built the first device in the 80s, they were immediately able to exclude this scenario already. Because if things interact weakly, you know, the standard model weak interactions are not that weak. And so if we can get a very pure environment, they should be seeing literally tens of millions of events. Instead, they see 2. Okay. So as with everything, there are always caveats. So what are the major caveats here? We're assuming spin independent and velocity unsuppressed. Okay. There's no powers of velocity that show up in this numerator. In fact, you get this enhancement at small velocity. So if I have a scattering rate that is velocity suppressed, and you showed in the tutorial yesterday that some of them are, then these constraints get very significantly weakened. Okay. So they don't go away completely, because even if you have a velocity-suppressed spin-independent interaction, if v is 10⁻³, it weakens the constraints by, say, v squared, 10⁻⁶, which still puts you in kind of marginal territory. The other possibilities are if the u and d couplings are suppressed. If the up and down quark couplings are suppressed, then because the proton is mostly made up of up and down quarks, your total cross-section is going to be suppressed. And so for instance, if I scatter through the Higgs mostly interacts with heavy flavor quarks. And so what I have to do is rely on the very small amount of these quarks that are floating around in the proton. Even still, Higgs-mediated scenarios, these are now being ruled out by Lux and xenon 100. Okay? So the sensitivity has gotten so good that these are ruled out by about 6 orders of magnitude, and these are starting to be quite substantially ruled out as well. Okay, and then the final thing is that they can interact with leptons and not quarks. Of course, everything that we've been doing is predicated on the fact that they have nuclear recoils. There are experiments that look for electron recoils, and they're beginning to get sensitivity, but right now it's not particularly good. Okay. So direct detection experiments are really the most powerful way of looking for dark matter, provided that dark matter fits into these categories, which a substantial fraction of dark matter theories do. But of course, there are always theories that don't satisfy these criteria. Okay? So are there any questions about this?
Do you know what those two events are?
No. They're sort of at the boundary of where their allowed region is. So it's possible that it's some fluke where there was a coincidence where there was a big peak and then something else caused a little bit of scintillation. It was reconstructed as a very high S1 over S2 event, but really it was just a mistake. I should say that their background prediction, so from, say, their Monte Carlo analysis and from testing and all this, was about one, plus or minus 0.5 event or so. So, I mean, this is a very consistent with their expectation. It's not like they expected 0.001 and they saw two events. And indeed, there are moments where experiments reveal results and there are three or four events and they expected one and people get kind of excited. But usually what happens is that the next generation of experiment comes on, and if that were true, you'd expect to see 1,000 or 2,000, and they also see two or three events. And so that just completely blows it out of the water. I should say, I'm not going to go into detail about it, but if you look at past iterations of this course and things like it, there was a lot of discussion of various anomalies with direct detection. Okay. Because there were a few experiments that did claim to see things. The problem is that where they claimed to see them was at very high cross-section and at very low mass. Okay. So they claimed to see things sort of up here. These were all nominally excluded by Lux and Xenon, but there was a lot of argument about, well, is their threshold really 5 kV, or is it 4.5 kV, or is it 5.5 kV? And people argued over this for a very long time. Then some other experiments that specialize in this regime came along and completely ruled all of them out. So it's not really worth talking about that anymore, except to highlight the fact that these experiments are quite difficult to do, and particularly when you're on the margins of where things are looking like signal versus not signal, it's very easy to have some, say, thermal processes or whatever bleed over into your signal region and for you to think, oh, I'm seeing some big dark matter signal. And this is why it's important to have several experiments with several different nuclei that can all check each other. And if it's really dark matter, you would hope to see it in a bunch of them and have it all be consistent. Okay. Any other questions? So the last thing in direct detection that I want to mention is spin-dependent scattering. So far, we've talked about cases where the cross-section grows like a squared. But for some, this is not true. And I'm basically just going to argue in some way why you expect spin to even show up somewhere in this discussion, and then write down what the answer is. So let's consider a different case than we had before. So let's consider an axial vector coupling. So this has a Lagrangian that looks like chi bar gamma mu gamma 5 chi, q bar gamma mu gamma 5. And just like we did yesterday, and like you did in your tutorial, the big question is we want to map the quark level interaction into a nucleon level interaction. So what we want is an out q bar gamma mu gamma 5 q. So what's this? What we want to do is we want to express this in terms of an operator that's involving the nucleon fields. So that's what we did for the vectors. We used charge conservation to map the quark current into the nucleon current. And then in the tutorial yesterday, you just used some results from lattice QCD that map these things into one another. But here we have a bit more Lorentz structure. So we can make some arguments based on symmetry once again. And that is that this combination, q bar gamma 5, gamma mu gamma 5 q, is parity odd. Right? If I do a spatial reflection, then I end up with a minus sign. And the reason is just, once again, this gamma 5 that's in there, and it flips the sign for left and right-handed things. So what we have to ask is, what in the nucleon is parity odd? And remember that the nucleon is non-relativistic. So it's basically at rest. So if you stop and think for a minute about what could be parity odd about the nucleon, what you quickly come to the conclusion is that the only thing is the spin. Okay. Yes?
So you say that's parity odd, but I mean, it's an axial vector compared to the vector whose spatial dimensions flip sign.
That's right.
Time dimension doesn't flip sign. So that's what you mean, right?
Yeah. So it's negative with respect to the naive expectation. So.
Okay.
Yeah, so the vector flips sign because, of course, going from x, y, and z to minus 1s introduces a minus sign here, but then there's an extra minus sign that rotates it back. Right. So you've seen this before in classical mechanics where you considered vectors and axial vectors. The angular momentum, which is the cross product of two vectors, the minus signs from flipping each of those cancel, and you get back the same thing. Okay. So we know that angular momentum is an axial vector. And so what this means is that we can write whatever that's going on in here has to be proportional to spin. Okay? So this is going to be some coefficient aq. This is going to be some aq times some other coefficient n out s mu n in, where this is the spin operator. And in non-relativistic language, the spin operator is basically just 0 because everything is at rest, and then the usual J total angular momentum vector. Of course, this is secretly S, but because it's not moving around, we can just say J. Okay. The reason being that the spin of nuclear objects can be both an intrinsic spin, like in the as in classifying representations of the Lorentz group, but also spin among the constituents of the nucleon, okay? Which is why we often use J. It's total angular momentum of the constituents. But if you think of the nucleon as a fundamental particle, it's the spin of the particle. Okay. So what this tells us is that the coefficient that we use for the nucleon is going to be, once again, just the sum over these different versions of the quark one, plus some expectation value of the spin operator inside of that nucleon. Okay. And you can show that when you then sum over the nucleons to give you a nuclear matrix element, this appearance of the spin translates into a total spin. What you basically get is the sigma dq squared is 2 over pi 1 over v squared. So this part is basically the same. There's some coefficient lambda squared. And then the angular momentum eigenvalue of the nucleus. So this is the nucleus. Cross section. And this lambda is defined as some combination of the different parameters and the expectation value of the nucleon spins in some external magnetic field. So these are all things that nuclear people tell us. And they're typically order one numbers. But the key thing is that this depends on the total spin of the nucleus. And nuclei, of course, are made up of lots of nucleons. And they tend to want to pair in opposite spin orientations. So there are a lot of nuclei that just have no spin. And in that case, dark matter just doesn't interact with them at all. Or there are nuclei with spin 1/2 or so. But The point is that this quantity here is going to be much, much smaller than a squared. And so generally, spin-dependent scattering rates are very small. And it shows that if I plotted the same plot but for spin-dependent instead of spin-independent, we would find that the curve would look almost exactly the same, but this best fit point would be around 10 to the minus 40 instead of 10 to the minus 46. That's still sufficient to exclude, say, axial vector coupling through the Z, but it's obviously much, much weaker than the spin-independent. So this is why whether dark matter couples in a spin-independent or a spin-dependent way can have a big influence on whether the model is excluded or not excluded. Okay. So for this part, the details are they're more nitty-gritty here, and so I don't want to get into it. So don't worry if you don't understand exactly the logic, but I just want to highlight that this is why spin shows up in these axial vector and pseudoscalar type couplings. And you get essentially the same kind of relation. You get some sum over the fundamental coefficients, except instead of a squared, you get j squared. OK, so are there any questions about this? OK. So that more or less wraps up our discussion of of dark matter direct detection. So now that we have our results for, say, direct detection and indirect detection, I just want to stop and make a comment about complementarity probes. Okay. So far what we've seen is we've been able to probe some of the different kinds of interactions. So we've gone in this direction for indirect detection, and we've gone in this direction for direct detection. And we've already seen in the tutorial some of the relative advantages and disadvantages. So if we compare them, what we've seen is that some of the operators that are, say, velocity suppressed in direct detection are velocity unsuppressed in direct detection, indirect detection, and vice versa. So for instance, if I have in direct detection, just a scalar coupling, this is of order 1. But if I have a pseudoscalar coupling, then this is order b squared. Here, they're just flipped. This is order v squared, and this is order 1. So what's nice about this is that it's easy to get around one of these. It's very difficult to get around both of them. So that's a plus. The minus sign is that if dark matter is, say, a pseudoscalar, I will see it in indirect detection. It will be very hard to see it in direct detection. And this is what we're seeing, for instance, in these models for this GEV galactic-centered gamma ray excess that we were talking about. Okay? That there we said, OK, you need a dark matter mass that's around 30 GeV. Well, 30 GeV is like smack right in the most sensitive region of direct detection. So the only way that that galactic center excess could be dark matter is if you do one of something like this, where you have a large indirect detection rate and a small direct detection rate. And this is particularly bad for direct detection because it's order v squared and it's also spin dependent. So it's kind of double effect that suppresses its rate. So that's good from the perspective of keeping my model alive. It's bad from the perspective of checking that this is actually dark matter. Yeah, Tibra.
why are we saying this is spin dependent? Because of the angular momentum?
Yeah, so if you go through the same kind of procedure, the gamma 5 shows up yet again as some contraction of spin with some property of the nuclei. So I didn't show that. I'm just telling. Generally, if they're gamma fives, there are it's going to be spin dependent on the quark side. Okay. The other bit of complementarity is that this has a sharp die-off at m chi of about 5 to 10 GeV. For indirect detection, we saw that it's very constraining at low m chi, both just from the direct Fermi measurements and from these CMB measurements. Okay? So there was some bound that went like sigma v has to be less than 10 to the minus 26 over f m chi over 10 GeV. So these bounds get extremely, sorry, 10 GeV over m chi. So these bounds get extremely, extremely strong at small mass. So this is another nice complementarity, provided that signals are big in both of them. Okay. And then we can do the opposite, which is that it's large rate at high m chi. Or rather, the sensitivity is so good that even if I'm at 1,000 GeV, I'm still 4 or 5 orders of magnitude below what I would expect from the thermal scattering, or thermal relic scattering. So that's very good. Whereas indirect detection dies off like 1 over m chi squared at large m chi. So these are two excellent strategies, but they're at the end of the day, it's only in this sort of 10 to 100 GeV range where they're both very sensitive to the same things. And even then, depending on the coupling, I may be able to turn on and turn off various, you know, one or the other. Okay. So this is both, this is a blessing from the perspective of constraining dark matter, which means I can cover an enormous amount of ground. It's a curse if I actually want to discover dark matter, because it means that if I see a signal in one, chances are it's going to be very hard to see a signal in another one. Okay. So what this suggests is that we want to have some other ways of looking for dark matter in addition to these two, and that's going to be the topic of the rest of the week. Okay. So any questions about the rest of this? Okay. So the last experimental probe that we're going to consider is going in the opposite direction, which is FF bar goes into chi chi bar. And this is collider probes of dark matter. And this is a relatively new idea. I mean, people have discussed it for quite a while, but I would say that it's really been the LHC era that this has picked up. This is kind of the big point. And part of it is that the center of mass energy of the LHC is high enough that you can actually produce WIMPs that are of order 100, few hundred GeV. Okay. And this is sort of like sexy topic in the media. Like I'm sure you've seen articles about how the LHC is going to discover dark matter. And so we want to be able to assess those claims and see how it fits into this picture of dark matter complementarity. Okay. So the process that we're going to consider, particularly at the LHC, although we'll consider some other examples, is we have a standard model. Standard model goes to chi chi bar. And we're fortunate that, or you are fortunate to be at the stage that you're at in this time where the LHC is really hitting its prime. Okay, so we have a big collider. And hopefully this year, it will start running at a center of mass energy of 13 TeV. This is compared to 8 TeV before. So this is a full factor of 2 improvement in the center of mass energy. And so this means that if we have some new heavy particles, that there's now enough energy in these colliding protons to produce them and to actually see them. Okay. So the topics that we're going to cover are basically dark matter production at colliders. So this is more the physics of how you actually make it and how we understand that based on our theory. So then what we're going to do is look at the dark matter searches, which is basically how do you find it once you've produced it. Okay, so then we'll look at some things about the LHC, some results, and then if we have time, some other possibilities of using colliders to explore very different energy regimes. Okay. So the LHC will always win if you need a huge amount of energy, because that's what it's built for. If you're trying to find things that are relatively light, it's harder to do with the LHC just because the characteristic energy scale is so high that softer, lower energy things just get lost in the mix. Okay. So dark matter production at hadron colliders. So what we want to do is take our interactions like we've been using in indirect detection or direct detection and say, put them at the LHC and see what the production rate of dark matter is. So we're going to assume some effective interaction for now. And we'll test later whether this is actually a reasonable thing to do, but it sort of makes things simpler. So we're colliding hadrons, and hadrons interact by a strong force. So this is, just like direct detection, mostly going to be sensitive to stuff that couples to strongly interacting things. So for instance, we can consider couplings to quarks of Q bar times some Lorentz structure times Q, chi bar gamma chi. We can also consider couplings to gluons. And for the couplings to gluons, we can't write down a dimension 6 operator. Okay. The reason is that we need the gluons to be in some gauge invariant combination. And so the leading gauge invariant combination looks like this. G mu nu, with both of the color indices contracted with one another. Okay. So this is just the kinetic term. Chi bar chi. So this has a dimension 2 3/2. So you can see that this whole operator is dimension 7. Okay. Now we have a problem. And this is exactly the same problem as we had for direct detection, which is that we collide protons, not quarks or gluons. So we once again need to learn how to map the quarks, the quark operators into operators involving the protons. Okay. So this is similar in spirit to direct detection, but this is in some sense opposite to direct detection. And that is that the energy of the protons are much bigger than the mass of the protons here. So in direct detection, we were assuming everything was non-relativistic. Here, we're colliding protons with mass of GeV. Each of them is carrying momentum of 6.5 TeV. So the Lorentz boost factor is about 10 to the 4. So qualitatively, the result we're going to find is very different, but the problem that we have is basically the same. So if we draw a picture of what's happening, we have a proton here. It's traveling this way. We have another proton. It's traveling this way. And the point is that The collision energies are so high. That in sort of a crude way of approximating it, the de Broglie wavelength of the proton is much smaller than the nucleon size. Okay. So from the perspective of this proton, I have some very energetic proton coming at me. Okay. And those very energetic particles in the proton are going to be sensitive to very small structure inside of this other proton. So what really happens is that there's a bunch of quarks and stuff inside of this proton and a bunch of quarks and stuff in this side of this proton. And it's the individual quarks that collide and give off all of our collision stuff. Okay, so it's the quarks and gluons that really collide. And by really collide, I mean that the very high energy collisions that we're interested in are going to be interactions of the fundamental constituents of the proton. And that's just because each of these is going at such a high energy that it doesn't see the whole proton, it sees a very tiny particle inside of the proton. This has a name, it's called the parton model of the proton. And what the parton model says is that the fundamental constituents of the proton and the neutron, et cetera, are point-like particles called partons, because they're part of protons. And by fundamental, what I mean is they are the degrees of freedom that scatter at high energy. So in other words, if I shoot a high energy beam at a proton, it doesn't look like a proton, it looks like a bunch of partons. Now this may sound very redundant to you because we live in a world where we know there are quarks and gluons, so we kind of know that the proton is made up of that. But at the time when all of this was being developed, it was not at all clear that this was what was actually going on. And it was Richard Feynman who developed the parton model. And the parton model, like I said, it didn't necessarily tell you what those fundamental degrees of freedom were. It just said that the proton was made up of these point-like particles. And this can be contrasted with a model, say, of uniform density. So if I have a proton that's of uniform density, and I have some very energetic particle that comes in and probes a tiny volume of this, this tiny volume has, say, a charge that's equal to the charge of the proton times volume of the interaction region over the volume of the proton, which goes to zero at high energy, like the volume factor. And so these were competing theories, and it was really in the late 60s, or around 1969, when they did these what are called deep inelastic scattering experiments. They took very energetic electrons and they fired them at protons. And they said, hey, when we crank up the energy, the cross-section just becomes the cross-section of point-like particle scattering. And that tells you that there are partons inside of the nucleons. Today, we know that partons are really quarks and gluons. But the name has stuck because when we're colliding PP, it's really the partons of the proton that are interacting. And I should point out that quarks and gluons were also proposed for very different reasons. Okay? Quarks were proposed to explain the flavor structure of hadrons, so why they were strange and strangeness was conserved by weak interactions and all of this kind of thing. So quarks were really more about trying to classify the hadrons. Gluons were about quantifying this color degree of freedom that they had discovered that was required. So all of these pieces were actually developed kind of separately. And it's only in retrospect that we can kind of put it all together and say this is what the proton is. And of course, now that we know about asymptotic freedom, the parton model makes sense. Because when we go to very high energies, the quarks and gluons are essentially free. And so you can just treat it as scattering off a point-like particle. But at the time, they had no idea that that was why it was. Yes, Tibor.
It's really like asymptotic freedom that relates the quarks to the partons, right?
Basically, yes. So for instance, you could have a parton model that's not, the quarks are not fundamental degrees of freedom if you have some weird other, you know, kind of potential or something. Any other questions? OK, so inside of the parton model, what do nucleons look like? So let's consider a proton. It is net UUD. Okay. What that means is that the total charge is plus 1, and you expect there to be 2 ups and 1 down. But at low energies, once we draw this UUD, we see that these UUDs can exchange low momentum gluons, for instance. So there are secretly gluons in the proton, because if I collide at a moment of them exchanging gluons, I can actually scatter off this gluon. Similarly, I can have pair production of UU bar. So this means that secretly there are also antiquarks inside of the proton. And there are also heavy flavor quarks, so S, charm, bottom, etc. But they're always produced in pairs with their antipartners. Okay, so we can think of the proton as mostly UUD, but with some extras. And there are names for these, so I'll use a different color to make it clear. These are called valence quarks, just because they're sort of the fundamental constituents. These are known as C quarks, because they're sort of from this sea of gluons that are going around. So the C is all of the G, U bar, D bar, you know, Q bar inside of the proton. And then there's also some C, U, and D. So most of the U and D inside of the proton come from the valence, but there's also some C component because you're pair producing the U and the U bar. Okay. And the C tends to be low in momentum compared to U, U, D. Because you can think of the proton as mostly UUD plus some other stuff that's dividing up the rest of the energy in the proton. So when I scatter protons, the very high energy collisions typically involve a valence quark, and the very low energy collisions typically involve the C. OK. So what we want to do is, when we consider a PP collision, we want to consider a parton from proton 1 and a parton from proton 2 and collide them. So what we care about is fraction of P momentum in the parton, and that's called X. And so this allows us to define something called a parton distribution function, or PDF. And the PDF is basically defined as some function I of X, which is the probability of finding parton I with momentum fraction X. Okay. And then all I have to do is weight my parton level cross sections with this probability distribution that tells me the proton cross section. So as an example, for starters, even though the LHC doesn't do this, we can consider E minus to proton goes to whatever, okay, an inclusive scattering rate. So what I want is E minus P goes to X. This is what I want. What I can calculate is sigma E minus quark goes to X. Okay, and this is just the usual Feynman rules to calculate this. So what we can do is get sigma E minus P is the integral from 0 to 1 of the sum over all of the quarks, u, d, u bar, etc., of fi of x, sigma e minus q goes to x. And just, I'm going to put a little hat on here. This tells me that it's a partonic cross-section. Yes.
So what is stopping a parton from having, you know, higher momentum than the total momentum of the particle? Because inside, you know, there could be collisions.
Well, so, I mean, the part of it is that these exchanges tend to be quite soft. So you're never going to have a significant perturbation on the momentum. And as we'll show, the probability of all of the PDFs dies off around 0.1. So there's a very negligible probability of having collisions that are much higher than 0.1 in X. And this is why the LHC, even though it's a, you know, it's been colliding at 8 TeV, the highest partonic center of mass energy that they've seen is on, like, you know, for single event is on the order of 4 TeV. Okay, because there's this, there's always a big gap between what the hadron. So I think technically it could leak out there, but the PDFs are so negligible there anyway that it's not important. Okay. So in calculating sigma hat, the relevant kinematic quantity is not the center of mass energy. It's not S, but it's S hat, which is the partonic center of mass energy. So this is, say, the k of the electron plus x times the momentum of the proton squared. And this is just saying that if the parton that collides only has some small fraction of the proton momentum, then of course the real collision that's happened, the hard scatter, is not going to be at S, it's going to be at S hat. This immediately tells us something else that is interesting and difficult about hadron colliders, which is that even if I collide two particles in the CM frame, so let's say these two have the exact energy, there's some x1, p1 here, x2, p2. So sigma hat is not in the CM frame. Okay. So the actual parton collision only happens in the center of mass frame in the very unlikely event that the momentum fraction carried by both partons is exactly the same. So in hadron collisions, we actually don't know what the center of mass frame is for any collision. All we see are a bunch of stuff. And so typically, we have to consider the possibility that it came from any range of number of boosts along the longitudinal direction or along the beam direction. Okay. So now, in order to do this calculation, we need to know what these Fs are. And once again, we use our helpful friend, which is using the symmetries of the problem. To constrain F. So in particular, when we sum over all quarks and antiquarks for that matter, and integrate from 0 to 1, this weighted integral had better be 1. The reason being that this is the this is the momentum carried by the parton. And so what we're doing is we're computing the momentum average over f. All this is saying is that when I sum together the constituents of all of the partons, it better equal the proton momentum. So this is just a statement of conservation of momentum. So even though we don't really know about the individual s, we can constrain them through relations like this. So if you measure some of the PDFs, we can indirectly infer the others. Similarly, we know that p is equal to net UUD. So for instance, the integral of f of u minus f of u bar should equal 2. Similarly, the integral of f of d minus f of d bar should be 1. And for all of the other ones, there shouldn't be any net number. So for instance, if I take the strange number PDF and the anti-strange PDF, this should be 0, which immediately tells me that f of x is equal to f bar x, which is exactly what you would predict from this gluon splitting model, where the s quarks come from a gluon, and so I always produce them in pairs. The only one that we haven't constrained here is the gluon. So the gluon is a very difficult one to constrain. Usually, to get the gluon, we need to use this kind of relationship. Okay? Because the gluon doesn't carry any electric charge, doesn't carry any flavor, it doesn't carry any of this kind of thing. So what we have to do is measure quite precisely the u bar, the d bar, s, blah, blah, blah. Then we can use this relationship, and we can infer the gluon PDF. And tomorrow we're going to see how they do this, what the PDFs look like, and then what the dark matter production rate looks like at the LHC. So are there any questions about the definitions of PDFs or what we were doing with them? Okay, bro.
So how are these PDFs determined? Or I guess that's either covered tomorrow.
We'll do that tomorrow. But the basic idea is that you take electrons, actually, so what you want is just to have one proton,
right.
And then you study the scattering of electrons or neutrinos or things like this, and you can infer what the PDFs look like. The other thing I should mention is that I've cheated a little bit here in that I've written f as a function of x only. It's technically also a function of s, which is the hadronic center of mass energy. The reason being that the characteristic amount of partons that we see runs with alpha strong, right? Because when I go to higher energies, alpha strong is lower, and so it shifts the spectra a bit. But this is just a log dependence. And so it's usually not too important. What's perhaps more important is that measuring this log dependence was one of the ways that they discovered the running of alpha s. The fact that these PDFs don't just it's called Bjorking scaling. If you ignore this root S piece, and then the running induces a violation of the scale. OK, so I guess we'll see you tomorrow then.